Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
From Harrah's Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harrah's.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
Now, from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, lots of changes. Changes in the ownership of our home casino. Changes in some of the rules for this year's World Series of Poker. Also, we'll help a friend of ours celebrate the fifth anniversary of his poker radio show, which now includes a TV component. And also, a little bit more about Amarillo Slim from a man who knew him in the last few years of his life. All of that ahead in the course of the next hour here on The Final Table. I am Paul Harrah's, sitting at the feature table of the Harrah's World Series of Poker Room here in St. Louis. My partner Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
A little tired. Flew back in last night, and as you said, as it seems to have been for the last year in the poker world, things are always changing.
Yes, they are.
Coming up.
Yeah. The big story here in St. Louis is that this casino, Harrah's St. Louis, has been sold to a company called Penn National Gaming. It is the buzz of the room here with both the players and the employees, and of course all the other 1,900 employees of this facility, all wondering what the future will hold. The deal will not go down for another 6 months or so because it's got to get regulatory approval, and as you and I both know, in Missouri, that means going through the Gaming Commission, which is not fun for anyone. I do want to address a couple of things that people have asked us about on Twitter, and one of them was, do you think this was because of the Missouri Gaming Commission? And I can tell you that the answer is no. Harrah's has had a very profitable property here. In fact, it has become so profitable that it has propped up other divisions of Caesars Entertainment that weren't performing well. This place was bringing in $20 to $25 million in profit every month, which you're the business part of our duo here, so I've got to ask you, Dennis, were the sale price for this casino of $610 million, considering this place brings in almost $300 million a year in profit, doesn't $610 million seem like a low sales price to you?
A little bit of a low sale price, but typically in business, you can take a multiplier of the profit anywhere from 1.5 to 7 times. When you're trying to evaluate a business, depending upon how risky the business is, what other possible consequences can be there, all sorts of different things. What I suspect on this is that while it's a little bit of a lower sale price than you might have expected, there are some other actions going on behind the scenes that we're unaware of, other agreements. And also this was a stock exchange of sorts, so there's a lot of tax consequences for it. Now, Caesars is in over 40 properties around the world. I mean, they've are trying to consolidate and get a more firm grasp on it. They're opening up a couple of new casinos. They have a fairly heavy debt load. So to eliminate part of the debt load to help facilitate opening up some other revenues that I think might be even more attractive, you know, it's just a business decision they made. Penn Gaming, on the other hand, seems to be acquiring and growing by leaps and bounds. They picked up the M out here in Las Vegas. A few years ago, they picked up the Argosy and those. They're opening up new casinos in Ohio. The first one's opening up at Cleveland on May 14th, and it's a large operation there. This one will be one of their flag pins, it appears as though. I think they had only about 1,500 total rooms in all of their other almost 20 properties. A lot of them didn't even have a hotel of any kind. There's 1,500 in St. Louis alone. I mean, this is going to be a major pickup for Penn Gaming and will be one of their premier sites. So business is business. Harrah's did it for a number of reasons. Penn Gaming did it for a number of reasons. I'm hopeful that this is actually going to be positive for St. Louis. Penn Gaming, I think, will come in, we'll make some renovations, we'll sink some money into it, we'll try to run some promotions. We'll see what happens, but, you know, maybe the agreement was to leave the circuit events for a couple of years. Maybe that was one of the side issues, maybe a lot of things. I'm not privy to it, but I'm telling you, there are probably some other little, you know, agreements in place to go with just the out-and-out purchase.
Yep. A couple of players have already come up to me today before we went on the air and said, gee, I thought this place was doing well. The circuit was getting more people than last year, and the business seems to be doing pretty well here. And I said, well, that's exactly the point. That's why it's a valuable thing to sell. You've got InCeaser as a company that does have a lot of debt, that's been trying to figure out how they can sell some of their properties off. And when you've got something valuable that can bring in a lot of cash, that can help you write down some of that debt, you do it. And they are also expanding. It's not like they're getting out of the business at all. When Penn comes in here, this will be rebranded as a Hollywood casino, just like the one that they've opened up recently at the Kansas Speedway, just a half hour outside of Kansas City, just like the one you and I have played in outside of Cincinnati in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Both of these places do have poker rooms. The company is committed to poker in its new venues in Ohio and in Maryland as well. So, you know, what will happen? I talked to a couple employees here. They are excited about it. What will happen? Yeah. What will happen to everybody who works here? We don't know, but we wish them all the best going forward. What will happen for the poker players in the area? This has been the poker room in town, capital T, capital H, capital E, the poker room in town for many years, and I think will probably continue to be that when the new owners come in.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I don't see a lot of downside to this. Penn Gaming is a very shrewd company. They've made a lot of good moves. They are rapidly growing. They're going to cater to what the players want, be they poker players, slot players, or whatever. And remember, you've got a total package there, which a lot of their properties at the present time don't have. You've got restaurants. You've got your new restaurant that just opened up there. You've got a 500-room hotel there. You know, you've got a large gaming floor. You've got a large poker room. I mean, they'll utilize these things. Well, their goal is probably going to be number one in the St. Louis market.
Yep. As for the circuit event, which has been here the last three Aprils and been more and more successful each year, just because Caesars is not going to be in this market or Harrah's, their subsidiary, won't be in this market, doesn't mean that the circuit won't be here anymore. As Dennis said, it could be part of the deal that it stays here for the next couple of years. And we know from places like the Palm Beach Kennel Club and the Choctaw Casino in Oklahoma that the World Series of Poker does go to other venues that are non-Harrah's properties.
Correct. They're looking to expand from 17 to 19 next year. They're not looking to eliminate sites. The World Series circuit event is just growing bigger and better all the time. I don't see why they would want to eliminate that. So I think some sort of a major poker event will happen in St. Louis and will happen at that property.
Do you know, does Penn Gaming have connections to the World Poker Tour elsewhere? So if the circuit weren't here anymore, that the WPT could finally come to St. Louis?
Oh, absolutely. That's a definite option there. They held the WPT at Lawrenceburg over in Indiana for a couple of years. They're not holding it there this year, but I know they have connections there. I know they're opening new properties in Ohio. It would not surprise me, but what they would have a couple of their properties, and St. Louis could be one of them, to host the WPT.
Okay, so that's really what we know here, and beyond that, everything else is speculation. In the poker world, of course, rumors spread about as fast as chips do. So what will happen over the course of the next 6 months is a lot of talk, but no one will have any definite answers until this deal closes, which won't happen until the fourth quarter of this year. I would think at least 6 months will go by because of the regulatory hurdles they're going to have to overcome. And, you know, that's how long it takes in the corporate world. So anything more we need to add about this part of the story right now?
Well, I think anything else we add would be pure speculation. Again, I think it could be a positive mood. I'm hopeful that it is. They've got a good crew of people over there in St. Louis. I can't see Penn Gaming coming in and doing a massive shuffle around. I'm quite sure that they'll want to put some of their key people in there, and there'll be a little bit of shuffling around. But for the most part, I think it'll stay status quo, and hopefully they'll come in there and just make it bigger and better.
All right. Now, one way it will affect players is For all the years people have been playing here, they have been accumulating total rewards points. That's the comp program for all of the Caesars properties, both Harrah's and Horseshoes. Once this is no longer a Caesars property, you won't be getting any total reward comps. You won't be able to use them in the building anymore. So you've got about 6 months to run down your card. The good news about it is if you're going to the World Series of Poker, which starts in just 3 weeks from yesterday, will be the first event. If you're going out there, Caesars has announced that you can now use your total rewards card to buy in to some of the tournaments, including the deep stacks and the megas and the satellites, including the gold bracelet events. But you'll also earn total rewards points when you enter into any of the tournaments as well. So it's not just when you book a room there or go eat at one of the places like the Poker Kitchen or one of the restaurants at the Rio or one of the other properties or get tickets to a show. You'll be able to get total rewards points just by buying in to these tournaments. Obviously, it won't be on a dollar-for-dollar basis, but they're expanding the player loyalty program to include people. Now, that means if you're going to go there this summer, you won't get a voucher when you buy into a tournament. Normally, they give you a $10 food voucher that you can then use at any of the restaurants on the Rio property. Instead, you will have that $10 added to your total rewards card, which you have to enter a tournament anyway, and then you take that card with you and you go buy in. I think this may eliminate a little bit of what you and I used to call the Alan Kessler problem, where Alan would buy in and then cash in and then buy in and then cash in and then buy in and then cash in multiple times into the same event and keep the vouchers.
There's always, I'm telling you, poker players are definitely always thinking outside the box.
I don't know if it was him or if it was somebody else who, when there was a $1,000 event a couple of years ago, he bought in and out of the event 10 times, got himself $100 in vouchers, and then lasted less than an hour in a $1,000 tournament, thus costing himself $900 for a bunch of dinners. Again, I don't know. I don't have confirmation that that was Alan, but I heard that story about somebody doing that a couple of years ago. This way, you'll have the credits put on your total rewards card, and then you can go use them somewhere else at the Rio.
Yeah. Now, quick thing. Now, obviously, you're trying to move up in tiers, and if you get up to a diamond level, it has nice advantages and everything like that. They said on the main event that they're going to give you 3,000 credits for anyone who signs up for the main event, that $10,000 one. My question to you is this. For the one-drop tournament, how many credits are they going to give them?
Let me tell you something. If you buy in to a $1 million buy-in event, and you're not automatically given diamond status, then the company is doing something wrong. Why would you not? Why would you not make Wales a 7-star?
Yeah, there you go.
I do know that if you win a bracelet at the series, you're automatically upgraded to diamond status. The rest of us have to work our way up through the points, or you know, the $1 million buy-in would certainly do it. While we're talking of the WSOP, they had their annual conference call for members of the press just a couple of hours ago, and I listened in on that. The big one for one drop, the $1 million tournament that you were talking about, is going to be televised by ESPN. They're going to be doing live streaming of the event on ESPN3, and then later in the day on ESPN when the event takes place on July 3rd. That'll be done on a 15-minute delay, and then they'll take the whole show and edit it down, and it'll be the kickoff of their Tuesday night coverage, which will run from the end of July all the way through the end of the final table of the main event at the end of October. As we've told you before, there's no November 9 this year. The final table will happen on the last Tuesday of October, because the first Tuesday of November, people might be a little bit busy watching the results of the presidential election. So one thing I asked about on the conference call today was when ESPN put out the schedule for the final table of the main event, all it said was that they would have near live coverage on ESPN as they did last year on a 15-minute delay, but it only listed it for Tuesday, August 30th. And I said, last year you did 9 players playing down to 3 on Sunday, and that was on ESPN2 and streaming online. what's happening to that? Will there only be the one night final table, which I couldn't imagine considering a final table can take 12 to 13 hours just to get down to the final two or three. They're not going to continue that coverage and play it out into the next day. So Jack Effel and Ty Stewart and Seth Polansky were all on this call from the WSOP, and they said, we can't say right now what's going to happen there. It could be Sunday and Tuesday coverage. It could be Monday and Tuesday coverage. It could be Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday coverage. All we know is the finale will air on ESPN on Tuesday the 30th. The other stuff remains to be seen.
Cool. So which seat are you going to be in?
Right next to you.
Cool. Left or right?
I'm going to be on your left if I have a choice.
All right.
Two other rule changes that you may not be aware of, because this is very fresh news that just happened 90 minutes ago. As you know, last year, Daniel Negreanu made a big fuss about the ability to talk at the table. This has actually been a topic of conversation since 2005, when Jamie Gold talked his way into a bracelet, winning the main event against Sami Farha and talking all the way and trying to get information out of opponents and telling them he was not bluffing and when he was bluffing and all the rest of it. The Jamie Gold rule was put into effect, which essentially said you can't say anything once you have cards in your hand. You can't reveal anything about your hand. Well, Jack Effel announced today that they have made a change. They want more verbal strategy. They want more talking at the table. So now, as of this year, you can say anything at the table as long as you do not expose your cards. You will be even able to say, well, I've got pocket aces here and I don't know what to do, in an effort to draw a reaction from your partner, from your opponent, rather. You can disclose your hand if you're the last one to act. Obviously, first one to act can't talk with action pending behind them. And they say that they are going to protect against collusion as best they can, but they want more talking, which will make for better TV. And in that vein, everyone at the feature table of every bracelet event and at the final table of every bracelet event will be urged to verbalize all their actions. They want more talking. They want more personality. Effectively, Dennis, they want it to go back to the way poker was before Jamie Gold. Your reaction?
Oh, no, I think that's a part of poker. I think that's something that's been eliminated somewhat because of their actions. And I love having people sit there and talk at the table to you. It does add so much of an element. Can you imagine some of the oh, my gosh. There are so many people that must be dancing a jig being able to do this.
Yep.
I love it. And I think it will add a lot to the entertainment value. I think it will add a lot to the strategy of the game. I think it'll just – I think overall it is good for it. The one question I have there is they have to be very careful that people don't get personal when they're talking about that.
Right.
You know, that's the one thing that's going to be kind of a gray area, you know, type of a deal. They got to be a little careful there, because you don't want to – you can criticize the other opponent even, but you can't verbally attack your opponent.
Yeah.
I guess that's a way to put it.
I think abusive language would be one of those things that would be over the line.
Oh, absolutely.
So when they
absolutely
say you can say anything, obviously there are lines, there's a box around what you can say, but that box up until today did not include the ability to talk about your hand. The rule always was you can't say anything that could induce action from another player at the table. That obviously is now going to be changed. And by the way, this is not what the Tournament Directors Association rule is. At other tournaments, it will remain that way, at least until they see how it goes this summer at the Rio, and then perhaps it'll change elsewhere.
As we've said before, this is a constantly changing industry. They're trying to tweak it and perfect it and make it better for the players. I think this is a move that will be better for the players, and you won't have Daniel sitting there, boy, I'd love to be able to talk about my hand. Boy, I have so much insight I could give to this. However, for some reason, I can't do that.
Right.
And that's exactly what he said at one of the feature tables last year.
Yep. You talked about, you know, there are people who are dancing a jig. The other rule was about excessive celebrations. You may remember, again, in response to the actions of a single player, guy by the name of Javad Khan, who you know from your years with him at PokerStars. Javad got up 3 years ago and would get up and do kind of a Tarzan yell and get in people's faces and jump up and really made a fool of himself repeatedly, very loudly, to celebrate every time he won a hand, whether he sucked out or held up or whatever it was. They admitted today that they went overboard in cracking down on celebrations after Javad Khan. And so this year they say you can let it go. Don't go crazy, which I hope means no more barking like we had from Ted What's-His-Name a couple of years ago. But yep. But you will be able to celebrate. You know, you hold up against a straight flush draw with your top pair, you'll be able to celebrate. You suck out with your two-outer, you'll be able to celebrate. You get into the money or get to a final table, you will be able to celebrate. You can't run around and knock other people down and go crazy in that way, but you will be able to celebrate. Again, I think a good change and a reaction to what players must have told them.
Oh, I agree 100%. And it's excellent that Jack Ethel and Seth and Ty and the other guys are listening to the players and, again, are trying to tweak that game for the enjoyment of everyone, for the viewers, for the players, for everything. And I think this is a move to the positive. So my hat's off to them.
So back to the TV coverage. ESPN will once again have Lon McCarron and Norman Chad and Kara Scott doing the coverage. The big one for one drop will be televised on a 15-minute delay and then in an edited two-hour version a few weeks later. They will also have the WSOP Circuit National Championship, which last year aired on Versus. This year it will air on ESPN. To do that, they had to drop another event. You will not see the 50K Poker Players Championship on TV this year. What that means is because it's not on TV, the final table won't be all no limit. The Poker Players Championship is an 8-game mixed game, and it will stay that way at the final table because it won't be on TV. It will be streamed, it just won't be on ESPN. Then beginning on August 14th, they'll have 11 recorded weeks of 2 hours every Tuesday night of main event coverage leading up to that final table coverage that we talked about. Also, they are going to be streaming all final tables of all bracelet events with another friend of ours, David Tuckman, doing the play-by-play of those. However, Dennis, this year they're not going to be doing live streaming of the main event feature tables on days 2, 3, 4, 5 like they did last year. They said that that cut in to their Tuesday night ratings of the highlight shows, and so they've decided not to do that. They say it will preserve the integrity of what people see on Tuesday nights, make more people watch it there, and then you'll get the live streaming of only the final table.
Okay, well, I don't know whether I agree with that. I can understand from a business point where they want the viewership during the ESPN coverage of it in the following weeks. But boy, I really will miss that streaming of days, especially the days 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah, I agree. That was a lot of fun to watch for people who are really into poker, but I guess as I speculated on last year's shows when they announced it, I said the casual poker fan will be turned off by that sort of stuff, and the people who are really into poker won't watch the Tuesday night shows because they will have already seen it. So I think they hurt themselves. Maybe this is the remedy. We'll have to see. So anyway, there's some of the stuff coming up at the World Series of Poker, which starts less than 3 weeks from now. Let's bring in our first guest for the day here on the final table. It's our old friend Bernard Lee. Bernard, you know from his work for ESPN on their online show, The Inside Deal, which I'm sure will be ramping up for big coverage this summer at the Rio. Bernard also has his own poker radio show, which today is celebrating 5 years on the air. And for that, he's got something special that he's been doing. Hi, Bernard. How are you?
How are you guys doing?
Great. Happy anniversary.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's we are going to be airing our 5th anniversary show tonight at 6 Eastern. And we are very pleased and really amazed at how fast 5 years goes by.
And you're also doing something for TV with Dennis, right?
Correct. So what we did for the 5th anniversary is, the one nice thing about the radio show, it's really gone across all mediums. We started on radio, It's on the internet with roundersradio.com. It's on podcasts, on iTunes. And at the beginning of this year, when we were thinking about what we could do for our 50-year anniversary, what other medium could we tackle? And, of course, that's TV. And so we decided to bring it to TV, and we're bringing three episodes of the Bernard Lee Poker Show to TV. The first one aired last night. People can see it in the New England area on Comcast Sportsnet New England. People across the country can see it on DirecTV on Comcast Sports New England. I believe it's Channel 630 on DirecTV. And also, if you can't see that, you can watch it on our YouTube page. It'll be on about a week after it airs. Next week will be your very own Dennis Phillips coming on Monday night. And then the last show will be the iconic poker brat himself, Phil Hellmuth.
I tell you, having Bernard Lee sitting across the table to you doing an interview is always a pleasure because he is so insightful. He's been doing this for about 5 years. We did this interview in record time, just by two friends sitting down and talking. That's all it was. It was awesome. I loved it.
Well, yeah, and of course, Dennis and I have known each other since his run back in 2008, and my wife and I were watching the Chris Moneymaker one the other day, and she said, "You guys seem so natural. You guys just seem like you're just two buddies talking." I said, "Wait till you see Dennis's one. It's the same thing." And in all honesty, even with Phil, since I've gotten to know him recently, it felt that way as well. So we really were able to do these shows. It didn't have many takes at all because we knew each other pretty well, and the stories were there. And I think that we're bringing some really interesting stories to public. As my wife said, is that she knew a lot of the headlines of the stories, but she didn't know the details. And I think that that's what's going to be real interesting for the TV show.
Well, congratulations. Go ahead, Dennis. I'm sorry.
We did get in depth with a couple of things there. I revealed a little more than maybe I even intended to, but it's just so casual and so nice talking to Bernard. That what the heck, we just opened up and had some fun.
Yeah, it definitely was a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll get some great response to your show next week. Dennis's show will be on Monday night, 8:30 on Comcast Sportsnet New England. The only small caveat is that the Celtics obviously preempts anything on Comcast Sportsnet at this time of year. And depending on the schedule, it could get preempted, but it probably won't be depending on the schedules right now.
All right. Congratulations again on that. And we look forward to a summer full of inside deal stuff with you on ESPN. While I have you here, Dennis and I were going to talk about a question that we got from a Twitter follower, and we'll bring you in on as well. A listener by the name of Cameron Ward tweeted this question. What is your day one advice for somebody playing a $1,500 buy-in event at the WSOP for the first time? Bernard, you've played many of these events, and you travel around and play tournaments all over the country that are at about that buy-in level. So for somebody who's going to the Rio and is going to play one of these as a rookie, what would you tell them to be prepared for?
Well, it's a great question, and I think I've had this question asked to me numerous times, and the first thing I will say has nothing to do about the tournament itself. What I would recommend them do is come in a day early. And the reason is that you don't want to sit down at a World Series bracelet event for the first time and be in awe of the experience. You really want to soak in the 250 tables that are going to be in the Amazon and Pavilion rooms. You want to hear the shuffling of the chips, you want to hear the shuffling of the cards, and you want to hear the banter among those people. So, for example, if you're coming in to play a 1500 event on Saturday, I would highly recommend that you fly in on Friday. I would highly recommend that you walk around the room, experience seeing Daniel Negreanu, seeing Dennis Phillips, seeing all these people and being, just a spectator. Because once you get that out of your system, then you can play a day one and play your game and not be in awe of the World Series for the first 2 or 3 hours because if you are like that for the first 2 or 3 hours, you could be out before you even get going. And I have seen so many people be put into that situation. So that would be my number one advice. Seems kind of like that didn't answer my question, but I think that that could actually save you $1,500 if you just do that.
Actually, I would even go a step further than that. That's excellent advice. I would come in on a Friday, and I would make it a point to go down there that Friday night and walk
Absolutely.
Through the rooms and check right. it out so you can see the colors of the chips, so you can locate your table. I would register that night because I've seen
yes.
people wait in line for 2 hours to get up there to get their ticket and then go running to their table, and they're a little bit on tilt. They're just, you know, so many different things there. Buy your buy-in the night before, or go down early and do it, and then eat breakfast. But get comfortable. I guess that's the key thing. Get comfortable.
Yeah, I agree. And if I didn't make that clear, Dennis, thank you for saying that. Because yeah, I mean, you need to be able to see where you're going to be, how it all plays out. Because this isn't the tournament that you're playing in your friend's basement. This is the World Series of Poker. And the registration aspect is a great point because they're open 24 hours. I always register for the next day's event before I go to bed. And usually I'm up around 1 or 2 in the morning, and there's never a line. Why people show up at 11:30 and think that there's going to be no line, I have no idea. It makes no sense to me.
One other thing I would add to that is if you get there a day early, you'll be able to walk through and hear all of the people whining about their bad beats, and perhaps that'll keep you from telling your story 1,000 times to everyone you see.
Right. I would say that with regards to play, you don't have a lot of chips. You're going to be starting out at 25-25 with 4,500 chips. And I will tell you that if you make it through day one, which is not a long time, it'll be 10 to 11 levels. If you make it through day one, you are going to be very, very close to the money, if not make the money. They talked about it during the World Series conference call today. They may add a level so that we get closer to the money. So put that into your perspective, that if you make it through day one, you'll be very close to cashing in a World Series event. And, of course, as a rookie, that's a huge accomplishment if you make it.
Yeah, it's kind of a balancing act there because you start out not like the normal deep stacks that have been prevalent around the country now. You're only starting with 4,500. And when those blinds go up, it won't be very long until you're going to have to do something. But,
right.
again, though, you have hour-long levels. You can be patient. And you know if you survive that first day, you're probably going to make the money. So it's kind of a balancing act there.
All right, Cameron, thank you very much for your question. Good advice for you from two guys who have played in a lot of events at exactly that buy-in level and have made some money at that level through the years as well. Bernard, thank you so much for joining us.
I got one other thing real quick, if I could, Paul, something that you aren't aware of. I just found out.
Okay.
I just talked to Chris Moneymaker on the phone a few minutes ago.
Yep.
Chris is all excited. He is going to start up a radio show in probably 2 to 3 weeks. They're going to call it Money Talks.
Huh.
And he's looking for people like Bernard and me and Paul to give him some advice because he says, I'm all excited, but, you know, I'm not for sure what I'm going to do.
All right, here's my advice. You should get there a day early.
Register the night before.
Right. Bernard, we got to run, but thank you so much. Congratulations on your 5th anniversary of the Bernard Lee Poker Show.
Well, I appreciate it, and definitely, if I can mention, follow Twitter, Bernard Lee Poker, and you'll be able to participate in some of our contests this month for the anniversary, and thanks for having me on, guys.
Always a pleasure.
Take care, Bernard.
We'll see you at the Rio in a few weeks. Bernard Lee joining us here on the final table. Quick reminder that this weekend here at Harrah's St. Louis, another wild card weekend, $100 buy-in events that could eventually put you into the $1 million buy-in, the big one for one drop this summer. All you got to do is win your table to get your $100 back and qualify for step two, which is the $565 buy-in event on May 20th. You win that one, then you go on to the 25K satellite out at the Rio with your airfare and your hotel paid for. And if you win that one, you're going to end up in the $1 million buy-in. You think to yourself, well, that's a long way to go. Sure, but after you've got your $100 back, at the minimum, you're working towards a free trip to Vegas this summer. that's not a bad deal. You get in on it by playing the wild card weekend tournaments. Fridays at 1 and 7 p.m. Saturdays at noon, 3 and 6, $100 buy-in. More information, go to harrahs.com/STLPoker or like the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room on Facebook. And now we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with some more stories about Amarillo Slim from Michael Hershenson, a guy who was a business associate and friend of Slim's over the last few years and has some more insight to share over the story that we've told you about that made Slim from a poker hero to a poker pariah. That's when we come back with the Final Table Poker Show. He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. This is 590 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is $91,000. The tournaments and cash games going on around me, and our PLO game starts in about 25 minutes as soon as we finish our show. I'm Paul Harris. Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. We told you last week the sad news about the death of one of the greats of poker, a member of the Poker Hall of Fame, Amarillo Slim. Doyle Brunson, who knew Slim from the days when he and Sailor Roberts and Slim would round on the road through Texas, put something about Slim on his website last week, and I just want to share with you a couple of paragraphs from that. This is Doyle speaking. People always ask me if Slim was a great player, and was he as good as Sailor and me? My answer is no, not quite, but he was way above the average player. Slim's major contribution to our partnership was arranging games and promoting people to play with us. He had a gift of gab that I've never seen equaled. He was absolutely fearless and could not be embarrassed about anything. Unfortunately, he was tall and skinny and couldn't fight his way out of a paper bag, and Sailor was too easygoing, so I always had to do the fighting when things got out of hand. My eyebrows are full of scar tissue because of them, but we had lots of outrageous adventures and plenty of fun. We were robbed at gunpoint 4 times, arrested many times, had several dangerous situations. So why did we continue doing it for 7 years? Simple. We loved poker. I never saw Slim lose a prop bet when he bet serious money. The fact that he won 4 WSOP bracelets and is a member of 5 Hall of Fames attests to his ability. Poker owes him a lot. He brought respectability to poker after his 1972 win of the WSOP Championship, going on all the TV shows and telling them his stories. I'll finish with my favorite quote from Slim. I never go looking for a sucker to beat. I look for a champion and make a sucker out of him. R.I.P. Amarillo Slim. Those are the words of his old friend Doyle Brunson. Now, here's a guy who didn't know Slim all those years ago, but did know Slim for the last few years. His name is Michael Hershenson, and it was because of Michael that Dennis and I got to talk to Slim in that conversation that we put up as a special podcast, show number 169, which is available on thechipleader.com or iTunes or on Stitcher Radio, about a 45-minute conversation we had with Slim at the Rio back in May of 2009. Michael was the one who set that up as a friend and business associate of Slim, so we've asked him to join us here today to talk a little bit about the man. Hi, Michael, how are you?
Afternoon. Thanks for having me on the show.
So before we talk about some stories about Slim, explain to our audience what your relationship was with him. You weren't really a manager. You weren't really an agent for him, but you got to know the guy pretty darn well, right?
I did. He said he don't need any damn agent, but, you know, if I could help him out, that would be great, and he'd take care of me.
Now, one of the stories that we've talked about a little bit on the show and which Slim talked about in our interview with him in 2009 were the charges against him that go back to 2003, the charges that he had done some inappropriate touching of a little girl who was his granddaughter. These charges led to Slim becoming a pariah in the poker industry because that is a heinous thing for anyone to do. You know a little bit more about the people who were involved in bringing these charges against Slim, so maybe you could share some of those behind-the-scenes stories with us, Michael.
When let me start by saying my relationship with Slim. It began in 2008 when he approached me at the Bellagio Poker Room and heard I was an agent for several well-known poker players. As such, could I help get him a meeting with the Maloof brothers at the pond to see if they'd be interested in putting up some money, make his book, The World Full of Fat People, into a movie. Told him I had no relationship with him, but I'd look into it. Next day, I met Slim, told him I Googled him, and he said he felt something weird that night, but admitted he had no idea what Google was.
Mm-hmm.
I showed him some articles about the 2003 incident with Jock, because he said he didn't know about them. No one ever told him they existed. I discussed them with him and strongly suggested he have a public press conference with his family sitting next to him to set the record straight, since all was now okay with the family. He declined that approach, saying the bullet was shot from the gun, can never be put back in, plus he didn't want to have them relive that ugly time. But there was some interesting facts he told me about the case. When we spent 10 days together in Macau in November, December 2009, where Slim met me there to try and open up a poker pool room Texas barbecue enterprise. So I humbly ask your listeners and others to consider these facts and then see if you still believe what he did, what he was accused of.
Okay.
Number one, the prosecutor in the case had eyes on being the next governor of Texas and figured that if he bagged Slim a big catch, it would surely help his cause and get him some public attention, votes, and hopefully elected. After grand jury testimony against Slim, and he was not allowed to testify in his defense, including he was not allowed to include the results of the lie detector test given by the state, which he passed with flying colors. He was allowed to plead down from felony charges to a no-contest misdemeanor assault charge. And just as an aside, nowhere in the court papers was he ever called a pedophile or child molester. These were extremely ugly and damning words made up 100% by couple irresponsible members of the media, which took off and had a life of their own and caused greater harm to Slim. So my question to your viewers, the listeners, do you think if the state had a real hardcore evidence of the original charges, it would let Slim get off that easy? I don't think so. This entire ordeal came about over money, which the mother, and that's the mother of one of his sons, asked Slim for, but he told her, go have sex with yourself, mm-hmm. that he wouldn't be blackmailed or threatened by anyone. So she took her best shot, but since has recanted her entire story, as have other members of the family, signed, notarized affidavit, personally by Nolan Dalla, marketing chief of WSOP, wrote an article that sent back at pokerlisting.com
right.
April 2009.
And this is an important thing that we've mentioned, is that for anybody who still believes these charges against him, even the family members don't believe them, to the point where they have signed these papers recanting these charges against him. So I want to go back to this woman who is involved, who is the mother of the girl who I guess would be Slim's daughter-in-law. Was she married to one of Slim's sons?
Yes, she was.
You say this was all about money. How did the son go along with this, these charges against his father?
Well, based upon what Slim told me, I mean, it caused some problems, but he still maintained a relationship with his son.
Yeah, if I remember right in talking to Slim, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Paul, I think the allegations that this happened was in a pickup truck when his granddaughter was sitting next to him, and as he said, he was over there, it was a manually, he was shifting the truck and such. And, you know, it just snowballed from there.
It wasn't just his granddaughter. There were a total of four kids sitting in the front seat. So it was so crowded, when he reached over, he had to brush against somebody. But apparently, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong here, the girl said something about that when she got home, and her mother then, I guess you're saying, inflated that into these charges against him, right?
Yes, but there was one other incident that was put into the court papers at the Swims home at a swimming pool party, again, with the family and all the little kids. And that same little girl really liked Slim, and she came up and sat on his lap, you know, as he was dangling his feet in the pool. That also was put in as another or proof of Slim's, you know, bad thoughts about doing things to the little kids. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Now, when you and I talked a couple of days ago about this story, Michael, you were telling me that there's a part of the story that involves the psychologist who was assigned by the court to examine Slim. Explain that to the audience.
Okay, yes. There was court-ordered counseling, and I think it was for a two-year period. One of the counselors was a well-known practicing psychiatrist in Amarillo, Texas, who still is practicing there. After the 2 years went by, he began dating her and eventually married her on June 30th, 2009. So, again, I would pose this to your viewing public. Would an educated psychiatrist who was privy to the entire court trial, you know, date this guy and marry him, did what he was accused of to his own granddaughter? Again, it don't make sense.
Yep.
My mind actually went a little bit out there. I'm thinking of this poor psychiatrist that has to sit down and talk to Slim.
I since have met her, and I tried to get a Slim in a reality show in California. She came along. She's a very engaging, bright lady. She reads about a book a day. And you couldn't put anything over on this woman. I mean, although Slim is a great hustler and con man, there's no way, in my opinion, he tricked her or conned her. She simply believed him, had empathy for him, and fell in love with the guy.
Now, Michael, I want to ask about something that's kind of an offshoot of that particular aspect of Slim, the fact that he was a hustler and a con man. Do you think that that worked against him in the public perception in this story, that no matter what, and maybe this is why he kept quiet about it for 6 years after the incident, while he was dealing with all this with his family and with the prosecutor and with the court and all the rest, but that people would think, oh, well, that's Slim, you can't believe anything he says, because of that hustler reputation of his?
Well, sure, that's a natural human response. Guy had been around the world. He played poker with celebrities, presidents. A lot of jealousy enters into that. And, you know, when they saw he was wounded, they all, talking basically about, you know, the media, they jumped on him and tried to bury his face in the dirt. And he did not want to put his family in an ugly court battle, which he knew that the granddaughter would be put on the stand. So, in essence, he took an incredibly bad deed voluntarily, and he declined to do that, and knowing he could save his own skin. So, I personally think hardly there's another man on this planet would have taken this approach, and to me, that's the definition of a true stand-up guy. And as we know, he was eventually exonerated of his false charges by the person who initially brought them, the wife, because the family is still all together and happy and has gone on record that they were wrong to even brought the charges originally.
All right. Well, I appreciate you clarifying it and giving the other side of the story here. Let's talk about a couple of really positive things about Slim. I mean, Doyle came out with an article, and I have tremendous respect for Doyle, and if Doyle is a friend of Slim, that speaks volumes to me. He told us some of the old stories. Can you give us a couple of the highlights or something you'll always remember about Slim?
Okay, but before I do that, I'd like, since you brought up Doyle, I'm not sure that the listening public is aware of this, and I would pose this question to them. Would the godfather of poker and the most revered and respected player in the world go to bat and defend Slim public as he did in two previous blogs back on May 18th and June 4th, 2009? You can find them in Card Player. Basically said there was no possibility Slim was guilty as charged. See him doing anything like that after spending multiple years together on the road gambling around. There's no doubt Slim was a woman chaser, but only grown willing women. And just for the record, I called Doyle back in 2009 to ask him if he believed Slim did the thing to his granddaughter he was accused of. Doyle didn't hesitate and immediately said, no, it wasn't Slim, it wasn't possible. I then mentioned the agony Slim was still going through and had gone through over these years. Simply asked him if he'd consider writing a blog about Slim and what he just told him. Said he'd think about it. Later in May, he did, and followed up another in June. So I think that's testament to Slim, and if anyone reads Card Player blog of Doyle today, he's put a picture of Slim on the top left section of every old blog, Lewis one, as a tribute to his friend. And I think that is speaks volume.
Well, Michael, I think that speaks a lot about their relationship and also yours with him. I'm sorry we're out of time here, because I would like to have you share some stories, and maybe we'll be able to do that some other time. Thank you so much for joining us here today. We really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Maybe we can do it again, part two.
Michael Hershenson, who was very close with Slim, traveled with him, worked on business prospects in Macau and in Germany and the reality show and so much more, offering, I think, a little bit more perspective on a story that not a whole lot was known about other than what had come out back in 2009. And unfortunately, Dennis, I think too many people have been too quiet about this. I know Daniel Negreanu said some nice things about Slim last week on his blog and his video blog, and I just wanted to use our show today to kind of reinforce how you and I felt about the man.
I was pleasantly surprised when we met him at the Rio, how alert he was, the stories he had, the friendliness, the everything like that. I'm not too sure I ever want to make a bet against a man like that, because
yeah,
I would probably lose, but I'll tell you what, he was good for poker, and he was generally enjoyable to be around.
If you want to hear the interview that we did with Slim back in 2009, you can download it via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or get it on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. You just click on the final table radio show there. This show today is show number 171. That one was just a couple of shows earlier, number 169. You can listen to it and also hear in his own words what Slim had to say about this. But the whole interview is not about that. It's only about the last 10 minutes. The rest of it is telling stories about being on the road with Doyle and prop bets that he was involved in, the racehorse story, the ping pong Coca-Cola bottle story, and so much more. So thanks again to both Michael and Bernard as our guests today. And once again, we've run through a very quick hour of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis, what are your plans for between now and next Tuesday?
Actually, not too sure. Things are up in the air. Maybe I'll get some sleep. How would that be?
That's crazy talk. That's crazy talk. Well, I'm going to sit down here and play some Pot Limit Omaha here at Harrah's St. Louis, our home casino. We thank you very much for listening. Hope you'll join us next Tuesday at 3 for the Final Table on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.